You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Hello and welcome. I'm Tom Carver. Last weekend, Iran voted for a new president. There'd been plenty of drama in the run-up to the vote, with commentators talking about a conservative victory and the West's old nemesis, Ahmadinejad, being barred from running. But in the end, the incumbent president, Hassan Rouhani, won with a fairly comfortable majority. In fact, he actually increased his majority. In the last election in 2013, Rouhani squeaked in with 50.7% of the vote, and this time he won 56%. Talk of a conservative upset never materialized. Ibrahim Raisi, the conservatives' choice and the one rumored to be the favorite of the supreme leader Ayatollah Khomeini, won 38% only. The turnout was high, 73%, which is impressive when you consider that these elections are far from fully free. For example, the slate of candidates is chosen by the Islamic Guardian Council. Nonetheless, by comparison, the turnout in America's presidential election last year was just 54%. So what does the outcome mean for Iran's young population, for the region, and from the United States? With me here in our podcast studio is Karim Sajapour, our Iran expert. So, Karim, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. And I think that was such a terrific setup. I'm not sure I have much more to add.
There's lots more to unpack. So here we go. So first of all, were you surprised by the outcome?
I wasn't surprised in that the incumbent has won every single Iranian presidential election since the 1979 revolution. And Hassan Rouhani had essentially delivered on his main campaign promise of 2013, which was the nuclear deal. And his opponent was also someone, Ibrahim Raisi, as you mentioned, someone who was relatively unknown up until last month. And uncharismatic, deeply unpopular, hardline cleric who actually was implicated in some mass atrocities which took place in Iran in the 1980s. So,
and all that came out in the course of the election?
That came out as well. So the fact that Rouhani was running against a pretty weak opponent and he had the benefit of being the incumbent, I think it produced an outcome which wasn't terribly surprising.
I was reading an essay by Vali Nasser in The Atlantic, which I'm sure you read, and he called the result a bold political maneuver and a significant turning point for Iran, because he said Rouhani spoke truth to power towards the end of the campaign and had went on stages and talked to rallies about corruption. How significant was that, do you think?
I'm a little more skeptical than Vali that this was a moment of significant change in Iran, simply because we have seen past presidential elections, namely the election of Mohammad Khatami in 1997 and his re-election in 2001, where very bold themes were being discussed, even bolder themes of democracy, civil society, totally free and fair elections. And what I've noticed kind of in Iran over the years is that the government allows democracy to bloom for 3 to 4 days every 4 years, but autocracy is evergreen. It's always present. So I think with Hassan Rouhani, what may well happen is that now that he's been reelected, he no longer needs to appeal to the popular vote. In order to get his agenda done, he's going to have to cooperate very closely with those same forces which he really attacked in his campaign, namely the Revolutionary Guards and the judiciary. So I expect that people will be somewhat disappointed that he hasn't necessarily made good on his campaign promises. But it may well be that Rouhani is also thinking about bigger sights in mind, which is potential succession to Iranian supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who's really the main power in Iran.
Well, just before we get on to that, as obviously because he is, 77 or something, mm-hmm. the supreme leader, so that's an interesting area to look at. But has Rouhani then made an enemy, a powerful enemy of the Revolutionary Guard and those he attacked and accused of being corrupt? I mean, is that going to be a problem for him going down the fit track?
Well, it was notable then when Rouhani won, the supreme leader didn't congratulate him. He congratulated people for their turnout, but he didn't congratulate Rouhani. And I'm sure the Revolutionary Guards were not pleased to be publicly
singled out.
Yes, right. Publicly criticized like that. And again, I think that if he's looking at his political career, he's no longer going to be running for public office, but
because he can only run twice?
He's term limited, yeah. Although right. although he could conceivably sit out for 4 years and then run again after his term ends.
Right.
But again, I do think that he's probably thinking that he wants to be in the conversation to potentially succeed the Supreme Leader.
Hmm. And presumably that was also in people's minds about Raisi, right? Because he is a conservative cleric, like we mentioned, and I think a number of people see him or saw him as a potential successor.
Yes, many people thought that Raisi was someone who was being groomed to replace Ayatollah Khamenei. In some ways, Raisi was or is Khamenei's mini-me. He's a cleric from Mashhad, pretty hard line, very conservative, dogmatic views, quite anti-American. And, you know, you could make two different arguments. One is that now that Raisi has lost the presidential election, that diminishes his chances of being in the conversation for succession. On the other hand, he now has national name recognition in Iran, something he didn't have 1 month ago. And so one could argue that, you know, whenever that decision is being made about succession, you can more comfortably insert Raisi's name in a way you couldn't a year ago, simply because far more Iranians know who he is.
Right. Do you have any sense about the personal dynamics between the Supreme Leader and any of these people? I mean, do we know what the personal relationship is between Rouhani and Supreme Leader?
Well, you know, they all go back four decades from the time of the 1979 revolution, and they worked very closely with one another, certainly at the beginning of the revolution. But I think that in Rouhani's case, his thinking started to evolve in the second decade of the revolution. He notably went and studied in Glasgow. He did his doctoral studies in Glasgow. And he was...
He had a tough time understanding some of the lecturers.
Yes, I assume that he did. And, you know, there's a lot of controversy that he may have plagiarized his thesis. But Rouhani was really a mentee of the rival of Ayatollah Khamenei. That's the former president, Hashemi Rafsanjani, who passed away earlier this year. And I would say the basic distinction in the worldviews of Rouhani and Khamenei is the fact that Rouhani believes that in order for the revolution to survive, in order for the Islamic Republic to sustain itself, Iran has to start to prioritize its economic interests before revolutionary ideology. Kind of the vision they have in mind is China, the China model. Khamenei and Iran's hardliners, in contrast, believe that once you start to compromise on your principles, on your ideals, that's when the entire house can crumble on top of you. And the example they cite was Gorbachev.
Right. When
Gorbachev tried to pursue perestroika, the foundations of the Soviet Union were weakened. And so I think, you know, Raisi is very much in the category of the Supreme Leader, the so-called principalist. And Iranian politics are always impossible to predict. But I would say that certainly the individuals who, in theory, according to the Constitution, choose the next Supreme Leader, that's the body called the Assembly of Experts, and likely the senior cadres of the Revolutionary Guards, I would imagine they won't want to upset the status quo too dramatically. And so you may see a leader who doesn't diverge that much from Khamenei. But I do want to emphasize, you know, since I started doing this work in the early 2000s, I've been asked about succession to the Supreme Leader. And so people have been waiting for his death for a long time.
Right. He could be there another 10 years.
Exactly. Right? He could be another 10 years. A friend of mine joked that he probably has a paleo diet to complement his paleo worldview.
Obviously, the talk of the Iran nuclear deal was quite prominent in these elections. I was interested to read that none of the candidates actually advocated undoing the deal. Right?
That's right.
I mean, they all supported it.
And that wouldn't have been a popular talking point for any presidential candidate in Iran, because the deal was overwhelmingly popular with the Iranian public. This is a public, the vast majority of whom were really born after the 1979 revolution, or came of age after the 1979 revolution. And I would say that whereas kind of the organizing principle of the revolution was anti-imperialism and kind of Iran cutting itself off from global powers, I would say today for young Iranians, the organizing principle is globalization. They want to be part of the outside world. They want to be integrated with the outside world. And so the nuclear deal was a very important component in that. And so no presidential candidate, I think few presidential candidates would have gotten votes by running against the nuclear deal.
But was it right that to say that the Rouhani wasn't as popular as he might have been because there's a perception that this deal hasn't delivered very much to the average Iranian?
Yeah, I think that
it was... And his name is so associated with it.
Well, it was, I think, inevitable that people would be somewhat disillusioned by the nuclear deal just because this, you know, Iran is an economy which has been poorly managed and isolated and under sanctions for many, many years. It's still a very state-controlled economy, military Revolutionary Guard controlled cronyist economy. So whatever people's expectations were that after the nuclear deal there would be peace with America and foreign investment pouring in, that wasn't going to happen. But I think that for most people, the election was a simple choice in that Rouhani, though he may not have succeeded in his first term, at a minimum, people understood that he is trying to take the country forward, whereas Raisi was really a vote to kind of go back to the revolutionary fervor of the 1980s, which I think few Iranians romanticize about.
Talking about that 1979 revolution, of course, Donald Trump would remember that very well, and you know, who knows what effect it had on his political consciousness. But he certainly, he too seems to see Iran in that sort of framework, mm-hmm. doesn't he, and mindset. And it was very noticeable, obviously, how he didn't talk very much about the presidential election outcome when in his speeches in Saudi Arabia. Do you feel that that the election will shift at all, the Trump mindset towards Iran, which has been pretty hostile?
I don't think the election is going to have almost any impact on the views of the Trump administration toward Iran. What's notable about how the Trump administration views Iran in contrast to the Obama administration was the fact that for the Obama folks, including people like Secretary John Kerry, the prism through which they viewed Iran was really the prism of the Iranian foreign ministry, and in particular Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, who is a very urbane, U.S.-educated kind of cosmopolitan foreign minister. And Donald Trump's national security brain trust, people like General McMaster, the national security advisor, General Mattis, Secretary of Defense, these were all individuals who served in Iraq, and they hold Iran directly responsible, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards directly responsible for over 1,000 U.S. casualties in Iraq. So they very much view Iran through the prism of the Revolutionary Guards, and they essentially believe that Iran's president and its foreign ministry are not the relevant actors. The real actors are the Supreme Leader and the Revolutionary Guards. So I don't expect their cynicism toward Iran to change at all. And if you're Donald Trump and you're visiting Saudi Arabia and Israel, one of the few issues
right.
that unites
you're not
Gulf
be praising
Arabs,
Iran.
Yes, exactly, is attacking Iran.
On the other hand, he hasn't torn up the deal as he said he would when he was on the campaign trail. Do you think he is still going to?
It doesn't behoove either the United States or Iran to tear up the nuclear deal because this is a deal between seven parties. You know, you have the P5 plus one, which is the United States, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China, and you have Iran on the other side. And those countries which were involved in the negotiations, they've moved on. You know, China is doing business with Iran, Russia is doing business with Iran, Europe wants to do business with Iran. So if the United States were to just gratuitously tear up the deal, or Iran were to gratuitously tear up the deal, whoever does that will be blamed for it. And I think from the U.S. perspective, there isn't going to be the same global unity we had 4 or 5 years ago, because much of the world, with the exception of the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, increasingly views Iran as actually a stable actor in the Middle East. They view Iran as an ally in the fight against ISIS. And you mentioned Mahmoud Ahmadinejad earlier. He was really a godsend to the United States because he helped unite the world against Iran. With President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif, it's much more difficult to rally a global coalition against Iran.
But I guess Trump may not care about, you know, what Russia does or, you know, what the Europeans do. I mean, if you look through his prism of economic nationalism, America first, there may be still more benefits from his point of view of tearing up this deal, right?
Well, he may not care, but the reality is almost 100% of Iranian commercial activities are with countries other than the United States. So if the goal is to really squeeze and pressure Iran, and it's only a coalition of the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, you know, three countries who don't do much business with Iran, that's not going to really force Iran to reassess its nuclear ambitions.
How has the Rouhani victory been seen in Saudi Arabia?
I think likewise, Saudi Arabia is cynical because over the years, they've also witnessed Iranian elections. They've witnessed, you know, moderates coming to power, conservatives coming to power. But they haven't seen any changes in Iran's regional policies. I mean, a very good example is the fact that when Mohammad Khatami was president from 1997 to 2005, Iran's approach towards Israel didn't change. Its support for Hezbollah didn't change. Its regional activities didn't change. So those files are in some ways outside the domain of the Iranian president and foreign ministry. They're controlled by the deep state, by the Revolutionary Guard. So, you know, I think a lot of countries, including the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, say, you know, we've seen this movie before and we know how it ends. So they're much more cynical about the outcome.
And perversely, I guess they might have preferred to see a conservative as president because it would kind of reinforce this idea that Iran is the kind of evil empire.
Well, that's absolutely true. In fact, a couple conservative, neoconservative American thinkers wrote openly that they preferred Ibrahim Raisi to be president because Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu said this a few years back. He called Hassan Rouhani a wolf in sheep's clothing. And so they'd prefer to have a wolf in wolf's clothing.
Yeah. I mean, I've read some Saudis kind of waxing lyrical about the time before the revolution when the Saudis and the Iranians, you know, got on and, you know, there were flights between the countries and so forth. I mean, that memory, I guess, is increasingly distant now for lots of Saudis and for Iranians. But do you think it's now implacable, this Saudi-Iran rivalry?
You know, I remember in 2003, in the run-up to the Iraq War, there was a debate in Washington whether the road to peace in the Middle East went through Jerusalem or Baghdad, meaning is the key to stability.
I remember that too.
Yeah, do you want to reach an Israeli-Palestinian peace accord or regime change in Iraq? And I think increasingly there's a consensus view that the biggest source of instability in today's Middle East is the Iran-Saudi rivalry. And whether it's in Yemen, in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, the bloodiest conflicts in the Middle East all have elements of this Iran-Saudi rivalry. But there's a lot of confusion as to what America's interests are, who is America's ally. You know, in the fight against ISIS, I think many liberals would say that the United States and Saudi Arabia maybe friends, but they're not allies, whereas Iran and the United States are allies, but not friends. And I think the reality is that the Iran-Saudi rivalry in some ways plays well in both Riyadh and in Tehran. Iranian nationalists, Shiite nationalists, anti-imperialists, they all dislike Saudi Arabia. And likewise, in Saudi Arabia, there's kind of a nascent Saudi nationalism. There's a Sunni nationalism. And Iran is the adversary as well. So unfortunately, I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel for now in this Iran-Saudi rivalry.
Until there's some sort of major shift in the makeup of the governments on either side.
Either that or the regional conflicts start to hurt them at home. I mean, I was reading today a history of World War II, and it wasn't until after 60 million people were killed that I think Europeans began to rethink aggressive nationalism and the benefits of cooperation. And the conflicts in today's Middle East have caused the greatest refugee crisis since World War II. But it's not Iranians and Saudis who are suffering. Mm-hmm. It's Syrians, Yemenis, Iraqis, and others. So it reminds me of that old African proverb that when elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers.
Right. It's the smaller countries in between.
Yes.
Yeah. Where do you think Iran will be in 5 years, say?
So the pattern of Iranian history, or starting with the 1979 revolution, has essentially been kind of short periods of euphoria followed by long years of disillusionment. And at the moment, there is euphoria. I would say there's undue expectations about what Hassan Rouhani can do. And I think that that's likely going to be followed by disillusionment. At the same time, you just look at the demographics of Iran, and every year that passes, more and more people were born after the revolution. And this kind of death to America culture of 1979 doesn't appeal to them. They have access to satellite television and the internet. They see what's happening in other parts of the world. So I remember Shimon Peres, the Israeli prime minister, was asked years ago about the prospects for an Israeli-Palestinian peace. And he said, the good news is that there's light at the end of the tunnel. The bad news is there's no tunnel. And I think, likewise, I see light at the end of the tunnel in Iran because of this vibrant population. But I do think that the pace of change in Iran is going to be slower than people anticipate.
But I guess it would be wrong, presumably, to assume that because of this young population with no collective memory of 1979, doesn't mean to say they're not nationalist or not patriotic about Iran, right? I mean, just because they may be more pro-American doesn't mean to say they're less kind of pro-Iran.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the most nationalistic populations in the world that's been born in empirical studies. And I would say, like countries like Russia, China, kind of old, proud civilizations, there is at the same time a very powerful, what I call grievance-driven nationalism, this sense that Iran isn't fulfilling its natural place in the world because outside powers are trying to prevent that. So, you know, political culture is something which develops over decades and centuries, and it turns like an aircraft carrier, you know, very, very slowly. So I do think that that is true, that even though Iranians want to be integrated with the outside world, it's not that they want to be subservient to great powers. It's still a very proud nationalistic population.
Which suggests that the rivalry with Saudi may well go on, even if they become less fervent in their Islamism.
Well, I've noticed that the rivalry with Saudi Arabia, it's not something which just appeals to, you know, constituents of the Iranian regime. You know, I know secular Iranians living in Palo Alto who feel just as strongly about that. So the regime has kind of touched on something that they realize it kind of appeals to a broader constituency than they usually have.
Karim, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tom.